it was just gas. One day you feel your baby's twists and turns nonstop. The next day your little athlete seems to have been benched, and you barely feel a thing. Not to worry. At this stage in pregnancy, concerns about your baby's movements, while understandable, are usually unnecessary. The frequency of noticeable movements at this point varies a great deal, and patterns of movement are erratic at best. Though your baby is almost certainly on the move much of the time, you probably won't be feeling it consistently until he or she is packing a more powerful punch. Some of these dance moves may be missed because of the fetal position, facing and kicking inward, for instance, instead of outward. Or because of your own activity. When you're walking or moving about a lot, your baby may be rocked to sleep, or you may be too busy to notice the movements. It's also possible that you're sleeping right through your baby's most active period, which for many fetuses is in the middle of the night. Even at this stage, babies are most likely to kick up when their moms are lying down. One way to prompt fetal movement, if you haven't noticed any all day, is to lie down for an hour or two in the evening, preferably after a glass of milk, orange juice, or a snack. The combination of your inactivity and the jolt of food energy may be able to get your fetus going. If that doesn't work, try again in a few hours. But don't worry. Many moms-to-be find they don't notice movement for a day or two at a time, or even for 3 or 4 days this early on. If you're still worried, call your practitioner for reassurance. After the 28th week, fetal movements become more consistent, and it's a good idea to get into the habit of checking on your baby's activity daily. Finding out baby sex.
I'm going for my 20-week ultrasound, and we're not sure whether to find out the baby's sex or not.
Team pink, team blue, or team wait and see? Ball's in your court when it comes to deciding whether or not to find out baby sex, and there's no right or wrong way to play it. Some parents opt for a heads up on baby's gender for practical reasons. It makes layette shopping, nursery painting, and name selection, only one to pick, a lot easier. Others decide to get the baby gender bulletin early because they just can't stand the suspense. But a significant minority of parents still prefer to play the guessing game right up until the end, and to find out baby sex the old-fashioned way, when his or her lower half finally makes its way into the world. The choice is yours. If you do decide to find out now, keep in mind that determining the sex of a baby through ultrasound is not an exact science, unlike prenatal tests, which determine the gender through chromosomal analysis. Rarely parents are told they're expecting a girl, only to hear at delivery, it's a boy. Or less often, the other way around. After all, it's easier to miss a penis than to see a penis where there isn't one. Also, occasionally, a baby won't cooperate with the gender reveal, instead keeping those privates private with stubbornly crossed legs. So if you do choose to find out your baby's gender when you go for your ultrasound, remember that it's a very educated guess, but technically still a guess. What if one of you wants to find out the sex and one of you doesn't? It's not easy to make that arrangement work, especially if the one who knows has problems keeping a poker face or resisting hint dropping or blurting out to family and friends, but it can be done. Another choice you'll have to make if you opt to know the news, whether and how and when to go public with it. Some parents like to save their little secret as long as they can. Others choose to live stream the scan, making their discovery and their announcement simultaneously. Still others decide to milk the momentous moment for all it's worth while celebrating with family and friends at the same time with a gender reveal.
Second trimester ultrasound. Get ready for the big reveal of your baby's adorable features, at least. Moms-to-be are routinely scheduled for an anatomy scan, also called a level 2 ultrasound, in the second trimester, usually between 18 and 20 weeks. That's because a second trimester ultrasound is a great way to see how a baby is developing and to offer reassurance that everything is going exactly the way it should be. One of its most exciting functions, as far as many parents are concerned, it can give you the 411 on baby's sex, on a want-to-know basis, of course. That is, unless you've already scored those results via an earlier chromosomal analysis, Plus, it's fun to get a sneak peek at your baby, especially now that he or she actually looks like a baby. This more detailed scan will also give your practitioner additional valuable information about what's going on in that belly of yours. For example, it can measure the size of your baby and check all the major organs. It can measure the amount of amniotic fluid to make sure there's just the right amount and evaluate the location of your placenta. In short, the second trimester ultrasound, besides being fun to watch, will give you and your practitioner a clear picture, literally, of the overall health of your baby and your pregnancy. Eager to make some sense of what you're seeing on the screen? Your cutie's beating heart will be easy to locate, but ask the sonographer to point out baby's face, hands, feet, and even some of those tiny but amazing organs like the stomach and kidneys. Routine second trimester ultrasounds are usually done in 2D, which will provide just a flat profile of baby's features, if a very cute one, suitable for framing or uploading. Most practitioners reserve the more detailed 3D, which takes multiple 2D images and pieces them together to form a 3D rendering that shows the whole surface, resembling a photo, and 4D scans, which show baby moving in real time, like a video, to more closely examine a fetus for a suspected anomaly, such as cleft lip or spinal cord problems, or to monitor something specific that has to be seen more clearly. Currently, these more sophisticated and admittedly fun-to-watch scans are officially recommended only when they're considered medically necessary. That's because studies evaluating the safety of ultrasound technology show mixed results and, as yet, unclear potential risks. It's a gender reveal. Want to find out your little one's sex in the biggest way? Think one part Oscars, one part game show, all parts excitement, celebration, fun, and fanfare? Then join the ranks of parents making that big news bigger than ever, finding out and announcing baby's sex during a gender reveal, either at a party or on social media. There are plenty of ways to do a gender reveal, and you can get as creative as you like. If you're planning to reveal the gender to yourselves at the same time you reveal it to friends, family, and the social media stratosphere, don't peek at the ultrasound. Instead, ask the technician to write baby's sex down and seal it in a closed envelope. Then, let your imagination run wild. Some ideas. Drop the news off at a bakery, where a cake can be baked in the appropriate color and frosted to hide the news. When you cut into the sweet treat, you and your guests will see whether it's blue for a boy or pink for a girl. Or have a piñata filled with pink or blue confetti, or pink or blue candy to reveal your big news. Or a box filled with blue or pink helium-filled balloons that get released when everyone has gathered around, and with someone capturing on video, of course. Looking for more inspiration? You'll find plenty on Pinterest, Instagram, and YouTube. Not feeling the trend? Prefer to keep the news about your little one's privates, well, private for now? Instead of vying for viral? Don't feel compelled to join the gender reveal party. Share, overshare, or don't share at all, until delivery day, that is. It's your baby and your call.
Placenta position.
The doctor said my ultrasound showed that the placenta was down near the cervix. She said that it was too early to worry about it. But of course, I started worrying.
Think your baby is the only thing moving around in your uterus? Not so. Like a fetus, a placenta can move around during pregnancy too. It doesn't actually pick up and relocate, but it does appear to migrate upward as the lower segment of the uterus stretches and grows. Though an estimated 10% of placentas are in the lower segment in the second trimester, and an even larger percentage before 14 weeks, the vast majority move into the upper segment by the time delivery nears. If this doesn't happen and the placenta remains low in the uterus, partially or completely covering the cervix, the mouth of the uterus, a diagnosis of placenta previa is made. This complication occurs in very few full-term pregnancies, about 1 in 200. In other words, your doctor is right. It's too early to worry about the position of your baby's placenta, and statistically speaking, the chances are slim that you'll ever have to worry about it. Another reason not to worry, if you do end up being diagnosed with placenta previa, your baby will simply be delivered via scheduled C-section.
During my ultrasound, the technician told us that I have an anterior placenta. What does that mean?
It means your baby is taking a backseat to the placenta. Usually a fertilized egg situates itself in the posterior uterus, the part closest to your spine, which is where the placenta eventually develops. Sometimes, though, the egg implants on the opposite side of the uterus, closest to your belly button. When the placenta develops, it grows on the front or anterior side of your uterus, with the baby behind it. And that, apparently, is what happened with your little bundle. Happily, your baby doesn't care which side of the uterus he or she is lying on, and where the placenta is located certainly makes no difference to development. The downside for you is that you might be less able to feel those early kicks and punches because the placenta will serve as a cushion between your baby and your tummy, and that could lead to unnecessary worrying. For the same reason, your doctor or midwife may find it a bit harder to pick up your baby's heartbeat, especially early on, and it could make amniocentesis, if you need it, a little more challenging. But despite those slight inconveniences, which are no big deal, an anterior placenta is inconsequential. What's more, it's very likely that the placenta will move into a more posterior position later on, as anterior placentas commonly do. Sleeping position.
I've always slept on my stomach. Now I'm afraid to, and I just can't seem to get comfortable any other way.
Unfortunately, two common favorite sleeping positions, on the belly and on the back, are not the best and certainly not the most comfortable choices during pregnancy. The belly position for obvious reasons. As your stomach grows, it's like sleeping on a watermelon. The back position, though more comfortable, rests the entire weight of your pregnant uterus on your back, your intestines, and your major blood vessels. This pressure can aggravate backaches and hemorrhoids, make digestion less efficient, interfere with optimum circulation, and possibly cause hypotension, low blood pressure, which can make you dizzy. The less than optimum circulation can also reduce blood flow to the fetus, giving your baby less oxygen and nutrients. It's not unsafe for your fetus if you find yourself on your back every once in a while, but being on your back for prolonged periods of time, over weeks and months, can be problematic. This doesn't mean you have to sleep standing up. Curling up or stretching out on your side, preferably the left side, though either side is fine, with one leg crossed over the other and with a pillow between them, is ideal for both you and your baby to be. It not only allows maximum flow of blood and nutrients to the placenta, but also enhances kidney function, which means better elimination of waste products and fluids and less swelling of ankles, feet, and hands. Very few people, however, manage to stay in one position throughout the night. Don't worry. Repeat, do not worry. If you wake up and find yourself on your back or abdomen, no harm done. Repeat, no harm done. Just turn back to your side. You may feel uncomfortable for a few nights or even a few weeks, but your body will most likely adjust to the new position. A body pillow that's at least 5 feet long or a wedge-shaped pillow can offer support, making side sleeping much more comfortable and staying on your side much easier. If you don't have any of these, you can improvise with any extra pillows, placing them against your body in different positions until you're comfortable. Confirmed tummy sleeper? Try a pregnancy blow-up pillow with a cutout for your belly. Still not comfy? Try lying semi-upright in a recliner instead of a bed. Class womb?
I've heard of people reading to their bellies or playing music to give their babies a head start in learning. Should I be trying to stimulate my baby too?
Now hear this. While your baby can hear by the end of the second trimester and will even start learning from what he or she hears, there's no need to start piping in any kind of curriculum during pregnancy. Not only is promoting this early head start in music or language or literature not necessary, it can come with a potential downside, especially if it signals the start of extremely premature parental pushiness and begins placing too much emphasis on achievement at a too tender age. and before birth is definitely too tender an age. Fetuses, like the babies and children they'll become before you know it, develop and later learn best at their own pace, no prodding necessary. There's also the chance that when parents attempt to turn the womb into a classroom, they may unknowingly disrupt the natural sleep patterns of their baby-to-be, hampering development instead of nurturing it, just as waking up a newborn for a game of name this letter might. That said, there's nothing wrong, and a lot right, with providing a uterine environment that's rich in language and music, and much more important, about finding ways to get close to your little one long before you even have that first cuddle. Talking, reading, or singing to your baby while he or she is in the womb, no amplification necessary, won't guarantee straight A's or faster ABC's, but it will ensure that your baby will know your voice and dad's voice at birth and will give you both a head start on bonding. Playing music now may mean your newborn will recognize, appreciate, and even be soothed by these sounds later on. Same thing with lullabies sung or nursery rhymes recited. And don't underestimate the power of touch. Since this sense also begins to develop in utero, stroking your belly now may also help strengthen the bond between you and your baby later. Plus, it feels good. So turn on the Mozart, bring on the Bach, pull out those dusty Shakespeare sonnets, or pull them up online, and read aloud to your belly if you like, and if you can without cracking up. Just make sure you're doing it all to get closer to baby, not to get him or her closer to a spot in the school orchestra or an academic scholarship. Of course, if you feel silly performing for your belly, there's no reason to worry that your baby will miss out on getting to know you. He or she is getting used to the sound of your voice and dad's every time you speak to each other or someone else. So enjoy making baby contact now, but definitely don't worry about early learning this early. As you'll discover, kids grow up all too soon anyway. There's no need to rush the process, especially before birth. Approaching parenthood.
I keep wondering if I will be happy with this whole parenthood thing. I have no clue what it'll really be like.
Most people approach any major change in their lives, and there's no more major change than becoming a parent, wondering whether it'll be a change they'll be happy with. And it's almost always more likely to be a happy change if you keep your expectations realistic. So first of all, reality check, check, and recheck. If you have images of bringing a cooing, smiling, picture-perfect baby home from the hospital, you may want to read up on what newborns are really like. Not only won't your newborn be smiling or cooing for weeks, but he or she may hardly communicate with you at all, except to cry. And this will almost invariably be when you're sitting down to dinner or starting to get busy in bed, have to pee, or are so tired you can't move. And if your visions of parenthood consist of leisurely morning walks through the park, sunny days at the zoo, and hours coordinating baby's wardrobe, another reality check is probably in order. You'll have your share of walks in the park, that is, if you have one nearby, but there will also be many mornings that turn into evenings before you and your baby have the chance to see the light of day. Many sunny days that will be spent largely in the laundry room, and very few tiny outfits that will escape unstained by spit up, pureed sweet potatoes, and baby vitamins. What you can expect realistically, however, are some pretty magical moments and some epically awesome experiences. The feeling you'll get when cuddling a warm, sleeping bundle of baby, even if that cherub was howling moments before, will be like nothing else you've ever felt. Ditto that first toothless smile meant just for you. The coo that finally comes, all breathy and sweet. Sticky hugs and wet kisses and fresh from the bath snuggles. The reality is, they'll make all those sleepless nights, delayed dinners, mountains of laundry, and frustrated romance more than worth it. Happy? Just you wait, Mommy.
For dads, feeling left out. Let's face it, no matter how much the gender roles have evolved, biology still has its limitations. which means that pregnancy is, and will always be, women's work, at least physically. It's mom who carries the baby. Mom who's connected to the baby and has the bump to back it up. Mom who's doing the prenatal nourishing and nurturing, as well as the one taking most of the hits for team baby. She's also the one getting the bulk of the pregnancy attention. From friends, from family, from the doctor or midwife, even from solicitous strangers. And that can sometimes leave you feeling like you're on the outside of pregnancy looking in. Not to worry. Just because the pregnancy's not taking place in your body doesn't mean you can't share it. And the best way to keep from feeling left out is to get involved. Here's how. Talk it over. Your partner may not realize that you're feeling left out, or she may even have the impression that you're just as happy staying on the sidelines. Let her know you'd not only like to be let in, but that you are all in. Be a prenatal regular. Whenever you can, and if you're not already, join her at her prenatal appointments. She'll appreciate the moral support, but you'll appreciate the chance to hear the practitioner's recommendations for yourself. Plus, you'll get to ask all those questions you have. The visits will also give you much-needed insight into the miraculous changes going on in your spouse's body. Best of all, you'll get to experience those momentous milestones with her, hearing the heartbeat, seeing those tiny limbs on ultrasound. Act pregnant. You don't have to start sporting a baby on board t-shirt or a milk mustache, but you can become a true partner in pregnancy. Exercise with her. Take a pass on the alcohol and be your comrade in club soda. Make an extra effort to eat well, at least when you're around her. And if you smoke, quit. Get an education. Even dads with advanced degrees, including those with MDs, have a lot to learn when it comes to pregnancy, childbirth, and baby care, just as moms do the first time. Read this book and follow it up with what to expect the first year. Check in with daddy bloggers and join online in local dads groups. Download the What to Expect app so you can get updates and tips and watch the weekly videos together. Attend childbirth classes as a team and attend baby care classes for dads if they're available locally. Chat up new dad friends and colleagues. Make a baby love connection. A mom-to-be may have the edge in prenatal bonding because baby's living inside her, but dads can get close too. Talk, read, sing to your baby frequently. A fetus can hear from about the end of the 6th month on. And hearing your voice often now will help your newborn recognize it after delivery. Enjoy baby's kicks and squirms by resting your hand or cheek or chest on your partner's bare belly for a few minutes each night. It's a nice way to get close with her, too. And baby can feel your belly rubs, even hear your heart beating if you get near enough. Gear up as a team. Decorate the nursery together, pore over baby name apps, research prospective baby doctors and attend any consults. Become active in every aspect of planning and prepping for the baby's arrival if you haven't already. Consider taking off. Start looking into your company's paternity leave policy if there is one. That way, you'll be sure not to be left out of all the fun after the baby is born. If there isn't one, consider mobilizing other dads and dads-to-be around the issue. An idea like paid maternity leave, whose time has come in the U.S.
Wearing a seatbelt.
Is it safe to wear a seatbelt when you're pregnant? And what about the airbag?
There's no safer way for an expectant mom and her baby to travel than buckled up. Plus, it's the law in most places. For maximum safety and minimum discomfort, fasten the belt below your belly, across your pelvis and your upper thighs. Wear the shoulder harness over your shoulder, not under your arm, diagonally between your breasts and to the side of your belly. And don't worry that the pressure of an abrupt stop will hurt your baby. He or she is well cushioned by amniotic fluid and uterine muscles, among the world's best shock-absorbing materials. Skip seatbelt positioners designed for moms-to-be, many such as those secured with Velcro, won't hold up in a crash anyway, and other designs haven't been found to be any safer for moms and babies. As for airbags, don't think about disabling them. If you get into an accident, you'll be much safer if you have a functional airbag than if you don't. In fact, studies have shown that not only do airbags save pregnant women's lives and the lives of their babies, they don't cause harm either. When deployed during an accident, they don't increase the risk of fetal distress, placental separation, or C-section. To make sure your airbag is keeping you safe, keep your distance. If you're sitting in the passenger seat, set the seat back as far as you can. Your legs will appreciate the stretching room too. If you're driving, tilt the wheel up towards your chest, away from your bump, and try to sit at least 10 inches from the steering wheel. Travel.
We had booked a vacation before we got pregnant. Is it still safe to go?
Never again will it be so easy to vacation with your baby. Fast forward to next year when you'll be lugging along a car seat, diapers, toys, and childproofing kits, and you'll see why. So don't have reservations about those reservations you've made. But before you pack your suitcase, do get the go-ahead from your practitioner. Chances are your vacation plans will be green-lighted, since travel is rarely restricted during pregnancy unless there's a complication, or if you're super close to term. Once you've been cleared for takeoff, you'll need to do a little planning to ensure a safe and comfortable expectant voyage, whether it's a quick business trip or a leisurely baby moon. Time it right. When you're planning pregnancy travel, timing it right is the ticket, with the most easygoing second trimester typically travel friendliest. By then, first trimester queasiness and fatigue, less than ideal travel companions, should have eased up. But you won't yet be so big that dragging yourself around is harder than dragging your bags. Traveling down to the delivery wire also might mean risking going into labor far from your practitioner, and depending on your destination, far from a reliable hospital. Contemplating a cruise? Most cruise lines won't let you board if you've reached your 24th week. Choose a destination that fits. A hot, humid climate may be hard for your hopped-up metabolism to handle, but if you do opt for tropical, make sure your hotel and transport are air-conditioned and that you stay hydrated and out of the sun. Get your practitioners okay before booking a trip to high altitude. Also get the go-ahead before venturing into any region requiring extra vaccinations. Some may not be pregnancy safe, as well as other areas that are hotbeds of potentially dangerous infections, including water, food, and mosquito-borne disease, such as Zika virus. For information on travelers' help, visit cdc.gov/travel. Plan a trip that's relaxing. A single destination beats a whirlwind tour that takes you to 6 cities in 6 days. A trip that lets you and your pregnant body set the pace is a lot better than one that's set by a group tour guide. A few hours of sightseeing or shopping or meetings should be alternated with time spent with your feet up. Insure yourself. Sign up for reliable travel insurance in case a pregnancy complication requires you to change your plans. Consider medical evacuation insurance as well if you're traveling abroad or just far from reliable medical services, in case you need to return home quickly under medical supervision. Medical travel insurance may also be useful if your regular insurance plan does not include foreign medical care. Check your policy ahead of time. Have medical backup. If you're traveling far, have the name of a local OB handy, just in case. If you're traveling abroad, contact the International Association for Medical Assistance to Travelers at IAMAT.org. which can provide you with a directory of English-speaking physicians throughout the world. Some major hotel chains can also provide you with this kind of information. If you find yourself in need of a doctor in a hurry, and your hotel can't provide you with one, you can call the U.S. Embassy or the American Consulate for a recommendation. Or you can head to the nearest ER. If you have medical travel insurance, there should be a number to call for help. Pack a pregnancy survival kit. Make sure you take enough prenatal vitamins to last the trip, some healthy snacks, C-bands if you're susceptible to motion sickness, and a medication for traveler's stomach recommended by your practitioner. Something to leave out of your kit, jet lag remedies, including melatonin, that aren't practitioner approved. take healthy eating habits with you. Have fun eating while you're away, you're on vacation, but also try to eat regularly and well, and to snack as needed. The energy-boosting combo of complex carbs and protein will be especially helpful if you're dragging from jet lag. Also, don't forget to bring your hydration habit along on the trip. Getting enough fluids is always essential during pregnancy, but key for jet setters, dehydration steps up jet lag symptoms such as fatigue. Try to stay regular on the road. Changes in schedule and diet can compound constipation problems, so make sure you get plenty of the three most effective constipation combatters: fiber, fluids, and exercise. When you gotta go, go. Don't encourage a UTI or constipation by postponing trips to the bathroom. Go as soon as you feel the urge and can find a toilet. Get the support you need. Support hose, that is, especially if you already suffer from varicose veins. But even if you only suspect you may be predisposed to them, consider wearing support hose when you'll be doing a lot of sitting, in cars, planes, or trains, for example, and when you'll be doing a lot of standing, in museums, in airport lines. They'll also help minimize swelling in your feet and ankles. Don't be stationary on the move. Sitting for hours, especially in a cramped space like an airplane seat, can restrict circulation and even lead to a blood clot, something moms-to-be are already at higher risk of. So be sure to shift in your seat frequently, do foot circles, and stretch, flex, wiggle, and massage your legs often, and avoid crossing your legs. If possible, take your shoes off and elevate your feet a bit. Get up at least every hour or two to walk the aisles when you're on a plane or train. When traveling by car, don't go for more than 2 hours without stopping for a stretch. Will getting there be half the fun when you're expecting? Probably not, but to make sure it's not twice as uncomfortable, if you're traveling by plane, check with the airline to see if there are any specific regulations concerning pregnant women. Book a seat in the bulkhead, preferably on the aisle, so you can get up and stretch or use the restroom as needed. Or if seating is not reserved, ask for pre-boarding. On board, wear your seatbelt comfortably fastened below your belly. More and more often, the so-called friendly skies are also the go-hungry skies. Even if you will be scoring a meal or will be able to purchase one on board, keep in mind that it may be A, tiny, B, inedible, C, a long time coming because of delays, or D, all of the above. So plan ahead. Pack a non-perishable sandwich or buy a sandwich, salad, or yogurt and fruit at the airport. Just make sure you'll be eating it while it's still fresh. Stash some snacks in your carry-on, too. Drink plenty of water to counter dehydration caused by air travel. This will also ensure that you'll get plenty of leg stretching during frequent bathroom breaks. But don't drink airline tap water, since it's often contaminated with bacteria. If you're traveling by car, keep nutritious snacks and water handy. For long trips, be sure your seat is comfortable. If it isn't, consider buying or borrowing a special cushion for back support, available in auto supply or specialty stores or online. If you're traveling by train, check to be sure there's a dining car with a full menu. If there's not, pack enough meals and snacks for the ride. If you're traveling overnight, book a sleeper car if you can. You don't want to start your trip exhausted. If you're traveling by boat, check with the cruise line about restrictions. There are many for pregnant women, as well as about medical facilities on board. Check in with your practitioner for trip clearance, too, and to see if there are any meds you should bring along. Onboard medical staff may not be able to dispense to expectant moms. And of course, keep in mind when considering a cruise that morning sickness plus motion sickness could make for a trip-ruining combo. Also be aware that outbreaks of gastrointestinal illness are not uncommon on cruise ships and may be especially dangerous if you're expecting.
Mosquitoes find pregnant women delicious. If mosquitoes seem to love snacking on you more than ever now that you're pregnant, it's not just your imagination. Scientists have found that pregnant women attract twice as many mosquitoes as non-pregnant women, possibly because those pesky bugs are fond of carbon dioxide, and pregnant women tend to take more frequent breaths, thereby releasing more of this mosquito-friendly gas. Another reason why mosquitoes make a beeline for expectant mothers, they're heat-seeking, and expectant mothers generally have higher body temperatures, what with all that baby-making going on. Most of the time, all this added attention from mosquitoes is merely an itchy nuisance. But when mosquito-borne illnesses are involved, bites can spread disease that might be dangerous to you and your baby. That's why it's important to take precautions if you live in or must travel to an area where mosquitoes pose a health risk, including checking with your practitioner and current travel warnings before considering a trip to such an area. Stay indoors as much as possible in heavily mosquito-infested areas. Use tight-fitting screens on windows and doors to keep mosquitoes out. Wear long-sleeved shirts and long pants. Treat clothing with permethrin, or buy clothing treated with permethrin and apply insect repellent with DEET, picaridin, IR3535, oil of lemon eucalyptus, or paramethanediol on exposed skin. When used as directed, EPA-registered insect repellents are proven safe and effective, even for pregnant and breastfeeding women. Repellents with purified forms of plants like citronella and cedar can help ward off bugs, but since they're not as effective as DEET or picaridin, don't rely on them in high-risk areas. Always apply repellent after you've applied sunscreen, and be prepared to reapply sunscreen more frequently, since DEET decreases SPF. Products that combine repellent and sunscreen aren't recommended. Over the baby moon. Of course you're over the moon about your baby making 3 or more, but maybe you're also wondering how that particular life change will impact your future as a twosome, especially when it comes to the kind of carefree couples time that will soon be in short supply. Enter the baby moon. Call it a last, for now, hurrah. A chance to be happy-go-lucky, or happy and get lucky together, before you hunker down with baby. Whether it's a week on the beach, a weekend in the country, a night at a local hotel, or a day at a spa, more and more parents-to-be are booking a baby moon. That is, time, schedule, finances, and practitioner's approval permitting. The best time for a baby moon? Clearly when you're feeling your best and most energetic, which for most mamas-to-be is in the relatively comfortable second trimester. Can't fit a baby moon in, or just can't afford one, or maybe you'd both rather spend the extra cash on baby shopping than baby mooning. Or your pregnancy is high risk and you're not allowed to leave town? Consider a staycation-style baby moon instead. Pick a weekend and plan just for 2 activities you might not get around to for a while once baby arrives on the scene. Breakfast in bed, dinner in a movie, and, well, you get the picture. Don't drink the water? Yes, staying hydrated is important for expectant travelers. But if the purity of the water is questionable at your destination, plan to use bottled water for drinking and brushing your teeth. Make sure the seal on the bottle top is intact when opening it. Avoid ice, too, unless you're certain it was made with purified water. Also, at such locales, you'll want to be as wary of food safety as water purity. Avoid raw fruits, vegetables, and salad, unless you know it has been washed in purified water. If you're craving fresh fruit, wash it with bottled water and peel it yourself. No matter where you roam, steer clear of cooked foods that are lukewarm or at room temperature, as on a buffet, and anything sold by street vendors, even if it's hot. Of course, skip juice or dairy you aren't positively sure is pasteurized. Stay safe when you're dipping, not just sipping and eating, too. Check ahead about the safety of local lakes, rivers, and ocean you might be swimming in. Some may be polluted or contaminated with dangerous bacteria. Any pool you swim in should be chlorinated or be purified by ozone, saline, or ionizing. Ask before you dip. For more info on safe and healthy travel, visit cdc.gov/travel. Mile High Pregnancy. Wondering if the thinner air at higher altitudes is safe for everyday breathing when you're expecting? It likely is if you've lived at a high altitude for a long time, but altitude-induced pregnancy problems, such as hypertension, water retention, a somewhat smaller-than-average baby, can occur in women who have just moved to a high-altitude area after a lifetime at sea level. For that reason, many practitioners suggest postponing such a move until after delivery, if possible. What about visiting from a low altitude to a high one during pregnancy? Clearly, scaling Mount Rainier is out for now. But also think twice and ask your practitioner before booking that trip to a resort in the Rockies. If you must make a trip to a high-altitude destination, try to make the ascent gradually so you can adjust to the thinning air. If you're driving and there are places to stay along the way, try to go up 2,000 feet a day rather than climbing all 7,000 feet at once, or fly to a city that's at 5,000 feet, spend a few days to acclimate, then drive the rest of the way up. To minimize the risk of developing acute mountain sickness, the headache, nausea, and fatigue that can happen to anyone at altitudes over 8,000 feet, but can also produce symptoms at somewhat lower altitudes, plan on taking it easy for a few days after your arrival. Drink lots of water, eat frequent small meals, and seek to sleep, if possible, at a somewhat lower altitude. How safe is security? Getting through airport security may be a pain, but fortunately, it's not a safety risk when you're traveling for two. The very low levels of electromagnetic waves emitted by metal detectors are perfectly safe. You're exposed to them all the time at home, from your appliances, for instance. Ditto the wands, sometimes used by security agents. And those full-body scans? The TSA says they pose no risk, including to pregnant women and their unborn babies, with the radiation from a scan equal to 2 minutes of flying at a high altitude. Pat-downs may or may not be an alternative to the scan. You can always ask if you're concerned. If you qualify for TSA PreCheck, apply at tsa.gov, you may be able to avoid the body scan altogether, as well as the hassle of taking off your shoes and jacket and pulling out your bag of liquids, assuming it's available at the airport you're flying from. All about sex and the pregnant couple.
Religious and medical miracles aside, every pregnancy starts with sex. So why does what probably got you here in the first place become so complicated now that you're here? Whether you're having it more often or less often, whether you're enjoying it more or less or not at all, or whether you're not even doing it, chances are that making a baby has changed the way you make love. From sorting out what is and isn't safe in bed or on the living room rug or on the kitchen counter, to figuring out which positions best accommodate your ever bigger belly, from mismatched moods, you're turned on, he's turned off, he's turned on, you're turned off, to hormones gone wild, leaving your breasts more enticing than ever, yet too tender to touch, pregnancy sex is full of challenges on both sides of the bed. But not to worry. A little creativity, a good sense of humor, plenty of patience and practice, and lots of love will conquer all when it comes to pregnancy sex. Sex through the trimesters. Down, up, down. While that might sound like a new sex move, it's actually a good description of the roller coaster pattern most couples can expect their sex lives to follow during the 9 months of pregnancy. In the first trimester, many women find that their libidos take a nosedive, plummeting promptly as soon as pregnancy hormones kick in. And that slowdown in sexual interest should come as no shocker. After all, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, and painfully tender nipples don't make for great sex partners. But as with all things pregnancy, no two women are alike, which means no two libidos are alike either. If you're lucky, you might find that the first trimester makes you hotter than ever, thanks to the happy side of hormonal changes, genitals that are ultra-sensitive and ever-tingly, and breasts that are extra big and extra fun. Interest often, though not always, picks up during the second trimester, when early pregnancy symptoms have subsided and there's more energy to put into lovemaking, and when less time in the bathroom leaves more time in the bedroom. Never had multiple orgasms before? Or any orgasms, this may be your lucky break and your chance to get lucky again and again. That's because extra blood flow to the labia, clitoris, and vagina can make it easier to climax than ever before and to have orgasms that are stronger and longer lasting too. But again, nothing's a given during pregnancy. Some women actually lose that loving feeling in the second trimester or never end up finding it at all during their 9 months, and that's normal too. As livery nears, libido usually wanes again, sometimes even more drastically than in the first trimester, for obvious reasons. First, your watermelon-sized abdomen makes the target more difficult for your partner to reach, even with creative positioning. Second, the aches and discomforts of advancing pregnancy can cool even the hottest passion. And third, late in the trimester, it's hard to concentrate on anything but that eagerly and anxiously awaited event. Still, some couples manage to overcome those late pregnancy obstacles and keep up the action until the first contraction.
The ins and outs of sex during pregnancy. Wondering what's safe and what's not when it comes to making love during pregnancy? Here's the lowdown. Oral sex, cunnilingus, going down on a woman is as safe as it is potentially pleasurable throughout pregnancy. So don't hesitate to go for it. Just make sure your partner doesn't forcefully blow air into your vagina. Fellatio, going down on him, is always safe during pregnancy, as is swallowing semen, in case you're curious, and for some couples, is a nice way to stay close when intercourse isn't permitted. Anal sex. Anal sex is probably safe during pregnancy, but proceed to the back door with caution. First, it probably won't be comfortable if you have hemorrhoids, an occupational hazard of pregnancy, and it can make them bleed, which can really spoil the moment. Second, you'll need to remember the same safety rule of anal sex whether you're pregnant or not, but be especially fastidious about following it now. Never go from anal to vaginal sex without cleaning up first. Doing so may introduce harmful bacteria into your vaginal canal, setting you up for infection and risk to the baby. Masturbation. Unless orgasm is off limits because of a high-risk pregnancy, masturbating, with or without a vibrator, during pregnancy is perfectly safe, and a great way to release all that tension you're feeling. Sex toys. As long as your practitioner has okayed sex, sex toys, like dildos and vibrators, are a go, too. After all, they're just mechanical versions of the real thing. But be sure any sex toy you use is clean, and be careful not to penetrate the vagina too deeply with it.
For dads, the sex fear factor. Worried that sex might hurt your partner or your baby-to-be? Worry no more. As long as the doctor or midwife has issued the green light on all red light activities during pregnancy, and most of the time that's exactly what'll happen, sex is completely safe up to delivery. Your baby is way out of your reach, even for the particularly gifted. Well secured and safely sealed off in the uterus, unable to watch or be aware of the adult action. In short, perfectly oblivious to what's going on when you're getting it on. Even those mild contractions your partner might feel after orgasm are nothing to worry about, since they're not the kind that trigger premature labor in a normal pregnancy. In fact, research shows that low-risk women who stay sexually active during pregnancy are actually less likely to deliver early. So get busy. And not only will making love to your spouse do her no harm, it can do her a world of good by filling her increased needs for physical and emotional closeness, and by letting her know that she's desired at a time when she may not be feeling her most desirable. Though you should proceed with care, take your cues from her and keep her needs top priority, you can certainly proceed and feel good about it. Still concerned? Let her know. Remember, open and honest communication about everything, including sex, is the best policy.
What's turning you on or off? Maybe pregnancy agrees with your sex life. Maybe it strongly disagrees. Either way, all the physical changes you're experiencing are bound to have an impact of some kind on the sex you have or don't have, for better, for worse, or for a little of both. Symptoms that can turn you on or turn you off include nausea and vomiting. Morning sickness can certainly come between you and a good time. After all, it's hard to purr with pleasure when you're busy gagging up dinner. So use your time wisely. If your morning sickness rises with the sun, put After Dark hours to good use. If your evenings are queasy, hop on the morning love train. If morning sickness stays with you day and night, you and your partner may just have to wait out its symptoms, which typically taper off by the end of the first trimester. Whatever you do, don't pressure yourself to feel sexy when you're feeling sick. The result won't be satisfying for anyone. Fatigue. It's hard to get busy when you barely have the energy to get undressed. Happily, the worst of pregnancy fatigue should pass by the fourth month, though exhaustion will probably return in the last trimester. Until then, make love while the sun shines, when the opportunity presents itself, instead of trying to force yourself to stay up for late-night romance. Cap off a weekend afternoon of lovemaking with a nap or the other way around. Have the kind of breakfast in bed that doesn't leave crumbs. You're changing shape. Maybe the recent rounding of your body has made you feel sexier than ever, or maybe you're having a hard time embracing your new shape. If so, wrapping yourself up in some lacy, racy lingerie, yes, they make it for pregnant lovers too, may help you wrap yourself around those curves. If it's the physical challenges of pregnancy sex that have you down, as pregnancy progresses, the gymnastics required to scale Bump Mountain may seem too much like hard work. You can conquer those too. Your engorged genitals. Increased blood flow to the pelvic area caused by hormonal changes of pregnancy can make some lucky women more sexually eager and responsive than ever. But it can also make sex less satisfying, especially later in pregnancy, if a residual fullness persists after orgasm, leaving you feel as though you didn't quite make it. For your partner, too, the swelling of your sweet spot may increase pleasure if he feels snugly caressed, or decrease it if the fit is too tight. If swelling is accompanied by pain during intercourse, that could be a sign of varicose veins in your pelvic region. They can happen in the vulva, the vagina, and the surrounding area. Check with your practitioner. Leaking of colostrum. Late in pregnancy, some women begin producing the premilk called colostrum, which can leak from the breast during sexual stimulation and can be a little distracting and messy in the middle of foreplay. It's nothing to worry about, of course, but if it bothers you or your partner, concentrate on other parts of the body, like that possibly trigger-happy clitoris of yours. Breast tenderness. For some couples, pregnant breasts, full, firm, and maybe larger than life, are favorites that can't get enough playtime. But for many, that early pregnancy swelling comes with a high price, painful tenderness, and along with it, a look-but-don't-touch policy. If your breasts are bringing you more pain than pleasure, make sure your partner gets the message, and remind him that the tenderness will ease up by the end of the first trimester, at which point you'll both be able to enjoy a hands-on approach. Changes in vaginal secretions. Wet isn't always wild when you're expecting. Normal vaginal secretions increase during pregnancy and also change in consistency, odor, and taste. If you've always been on the dry or narrow side, that extra lubrication may make sex more enjoyable. But sometimes too much of a good thing can make the vaginal canal so wet and slippery that it actually decreases sensation for both of you, and even make it more difficult for your partner to keep his erection or reach orgasm. A little extra foreplay for him may help him out in that department. The heavier scent and taste of the secretions may also make oral sex off-putting. Some expectant moms experience vaginal dryness during sex, even with all those extra secretions. Unscented water-based lubricants are safe to use as needed when you're having a dry spell. Bleeding caused by the sensitivity of the cervix. The mouth of the uterus also becomes engorged during pregnancy, crisscrossed with many additional blood vessels to accommodate increased blood flow, and is much softer than before pregnancy. This means that sex, especially deep penetration, can occasionally cause spotting, particularly late in pregnancy when the cervix begins to ripen for delivery, but also at any time during pregnancy. This spotting is usually nothing to be concerned about, though do mention it to your practitioner for extra reassurance. There are also plenty of psychological hang-ups that can get between you, your partner, and your pregnancy sex life. These, too, can be eased. Fear that sex will cause a miscarriage. Stop worrying and start enjoying. In normal pregnancies, sex isn't harmful. Your practitioner will tell you if there's a reason why you shouldn't have sex during pregnancy. If not, go for it. Fear that having an orgasm will trigger miscarriage. Although the uterus does contract after orgasm, sometimes quite powerfully and for as long as half an hour, these post-climax contractions are not a sign of labor and aren't harmful in a normal pregnancy. Again, if there's a reason why you should avoid orgasm, because you're at high risk for miscarriage or preterm labor, or have a placenta problem, for instance, your practitioner will let you know. If you haven't broached the subject and aren't sure, ask. Fear that the baby is watching. Not possible. Though your baby may enjoy the gentle rocking during sex and orgasm, he or she can't see what you're doing, has no clue what's happening, and will certainly have no memory of it. Fetal reactions, slowed movement during sex, and furious kicking and squirming and a speeded up heartbeat after orgasm are just natural responses to uterine activity. Fear of bumping into the baby. Though your partner may not want to admit it, no penis is big enough to bump directly into your baby. Late in pregnancy, as baby's head moves closer to the exit, it's possible for a man to feel something during deep penetration, but there won't be any direct contact and definitely won't be any harm done. Your little one is completely sealed off and perfectly protected in your cozy uterine home. Fear that sex will cause infection. The amniotic sac seals baby off safely from both semen and most infectious organisms. Unless your membranes have ruptured, your water is broken, the seal is intact. Do check with your practitioner, though, if your partner might have an STD. Anxiety over the coming attraction. Sure, you're both preoccupied and maybe a little or a lot stressed out. You might be experiencing mixed feelings, too, over your baby's imminent arrival. And it's sometimes hard to have sexy thoughts when your mind's cluttered with worries about all those upcoming financial responsibilities and lifestyle changes, not to mention all those baby prep to-do lists. Your best move? Talk about those feelings openly and often, and don't bring them to bed. Your changing relationship. Maybe you're having a little trouble adjusting to the upcoming changes in your family dynamics. The idea that you'll no longer just be a couple, but a couple of parents too. Talk it over and you'll begin to see change can be good. The extra dimension in your relationship can actually bring deeper intimacy and even deeper sexual satisfaction. Feelings of resentment. Maybe he's feeling a little resentful because you seem more into the baby, less into him. Maybe you're feeling a little resentful because you're doing all the heavy lifting for a baby you'll both get to enjoy. Such feelings can keep things chilly under the sheets, so talk them out again before you hit the sack. Worry that sex later in pregnancy will cause preterm labor. Unless the cervix is ripe and ready, sex does not appear to trigger labor, as many hopeful overdue couples have discovered. In fact, studies show that couples with low-risk pregnancies who are sexually active during late pregnancy are more likely to carry to term. Of course, psychological factors can also add to pregnancy sex pleasure. Good news! For one, some couples who've worked hard at becoming pregnant may be happy to switch from procreational to recreational sex. Instead of being slaves to ovulation predictor kits, charts, calendars, and monthly anxiety, they can enjoy spontaneous sex for pleasure's sake. For another, many couples find that creating a baby brings them closer together than ever before, and they find the belly a symbol of their closeness instead of an awkward obstacle.
For dads, expectant sex explained. Sure, you've done it before, but have you done it pregnancy style? Though the basic rules of the game apply when you're expecting, you'll find that pregnant sex requires a few adjustments, A little finessing and a lot of flexibility, literally. Here are some suggestions to get you going in the right direction. Wait for the nod. She was hot to try yesterday, but today she's as cold as ice to your advances. As a pregnant woman's moods swing, so does her sex drive. You'll have to learn to swing along and to hold on tight. Warm her up before you start your engine. This may go without saying, always, but it's a must when she's expecting. Go as slowly as she needs you to, making sure she's fully charged on foreplay before you get in gear. Stop for directions. The roadmap of what feels good and what doesn't may have changed, even since last week. So don't rely on a possibly outdated GPS. Always ask before going in. For instance, you may need to tread especially lightly when it comes to those probably supersized breasts. Though they may have swelled to thrilling proportions, they can be tender to even the gentlest touch, especially in the first trimester, which means you may have to look but not touch for a while. Put her in the driver's seat. Choose positions with her comfort in mind. A top pregnancy favorite is her on top. Mom on pop? Since this position gives her the most control over depth and speed of penetration. Another is spooning. She faces away on her side. And when her belly starts getting between you, get around it creatively. Try it from behind with her on her knees, or sitting on your lap while you lie down. Be prepared for rerouting. All roads aren't leading to intercourse. Find alternate paths to pleasure that you both can enjoy. Masturbation, oral sex, two-way massage.
Position matters. When you're making love at this point in your pregnancy, and later on too, position matters. Side-lying positions, front-to-front or front-to-back, aka spooning, are often most comfortable because they keep you off your back. Ditto woman on top, which allows you more control over penetration. Rear entry can work well too, with you on your knees or sitting on his lap, facing his legs, while he lies down, aka reverse cowgirl. Him on top is fine for quickies, as long as he keeps his weight off you by supporting himself with his arms, but after the fourth month, it's not a good idea to spend too much time flat on your back.
Enjoying it more, even if you're doing it less. Good, lasting sexual relationships are rarely built in a day, or even a really hot night. They grow with practice, patience, understanding, and love. This is true, too, of an already established sexual relationship that undergoes the emotional and physical changes of pregnancy. Here are a few ways to stay on top. Enjoy your sex life instead of analyzing it to death. Seize the moment as you seize each other. Don't focus on how frequently or infrequently you're having sex. Quality always beats quantity, but especially when you're expecting. Or compare pre-pregnancy sex with your sex life now. They're two different animals, and for that matter, so are both of you. Accentuate all the positives. Think of sex as relaxing. And remember, relaxation is good for all involved, including baby. Think of the roundness of your pregnant body as sensual and sexy. Think of every embrace as a chance to get closer as a couple, not just a chance to get closer to closing the deal. Get adventurous. The old positions don't fit anymore? Look at this as an opportunity to try something new, or a lot of somethings new. But give yourselves time to adjust to each position you try. You might even consider a dry run, trying out a new position fully clothed first, so that it'll be more familiar and you'll both be more successful when you try it for real. Keep it real. Your expectations, that is. Pregnant sex presents plenty of challenges, so cut yourself some slack in the sack. Though some women achieve orgasm for the first time during pregnancy, other women find the big O more elusive than ever. Your goal doesn't always have to be mutual fireworks, perfectly synced up. Remind yourself that getting close is sometimes the best and most satisfying part of getting it on. Don't forget the other kind of intercourse. Talking, that is. Communication is the foundation of every relationship, particularly one that's going through life-changing adjustments. Discuss any problems you're facing as a couple openly, instead of trying to sweep them under the bed, and instead of taking them to bed. If any problems seem too big to handle by yourselves, consider couples counseling. There's never been a better time to work on your twosome than now that it's about to become a threesome. Good, bad, or indifferent, remember too that every couple feels differently about sex during pregnancy, both physically and emotionally. The bottom line, whether you're on top, on bottom, side to side, or not doing it at all, what's normal, as is almost always the case when you're expecting, is what's normal for you and your partner. Embrace that, embrace each other, and try not to sweat the rest.
When sex is off the table. Clearly, there are plenty of perks to pregnancy sex for all involved. But what if sex is restricted during part or all of pregnancy, or off the table altogether? If your practitioner has told you to abstain, often called pelvic rest, but hasn't issued specifics, ask for a breakdown. Is it a temporary restriction or a full 9-month ban? Is foreplay fine? Oral okay, but penetration prohibited? Anything goes except orgasm for you? Or anything goes but with a condom? Knowing precisely what is safe and when it's safe is essential, so make sure you get a list of do's and don'ts. Sex will probably be restricted under the following and possibly other circumstances. If you are experiencing signs of preterm labor, or possibly if you have a history of preterm labor. If you've gotten a diagnosis of cervical insufficiency or placenta previa. Possibly if you are experiencing bleeding or have a history of miscarriages. If your partner lives in or travels to an area with Zika, your practitioner will advise you to use condoms every time you have sex or to not have sex during the pregnancy, even if your partner has no symptoms of Zika. If penetration is off limits, but orgasms allowed, consider mutual masturbation. If orgasms taboo for you, you might get pleasure out of pleasuring your partner this way. He probably won't object. If intercourse has been okayed, but orgasms prohibited, you could try making love without you reaching climax, though this definitely won't be completely satisfying for you, and may be way easier said than done if you climax easily, you'll still get some of the intimacy you're both craving while providing pleasure for your partner. If all lovemaking activities have been banned for the duration, try not to let that come between you as a couple. Focus on other ways of getting close, the romantic, G-rated kinds you might not have tapped into since early on in your relationship, like holding hands, cuddling, and old-fashioned making out. Chapter 10. The sixth month, approximately 23 to 27 weeks.
No doubt about those tummy moves these days. They're all baby, not gas. Though you're probably still having plenty of that too. And as those little arms and legs start to pack more of a punch, those baby gymnastics and sometimes bouts of baby hiccups will become visible from the outside. Talk about a built-in entertainment center. This month marks the last of the second trimester, which means you're almost two-thirds of the way to the pregnancy finish line. Still, you've got a ways to go and a ways to grow, as does baby, who's a relatively light load compared with what you'll be carrying around in a month or two. Take advantage, and while you can still see your feet, if not touch your toes, kick up your sensible heels a little.
Your baby, the sixth month.
Week 23. A window into your womb would reveal that your baby's skin is a bit saggy, hanging loosely from that little body. That's because skin grows faster than fat develops, and there's not much fat to fill that baby skin out yet. But don't worry, the fat is about to start catching up. Beginning this week, your baby, who's around 11 inches long and just over a pound in weight, begins to pack on the pounds, which means you will too. In fact, during the next month, your baby will actually double in weight. Fortunately, you won't. Once those fat deposits are made, your baby will be less transparent too. Right now, the organs and bones can still be seen through the skin, which has a red hue thanks to the developing veins and arteries just underneath. But by month 8, no more see-through baby. Week 24. At a weight of 1 1/3 pounds and a length of about 11.5 inches, baby is now the size of a pomegranate. Baby's weekly weight gain is now about 6 ounces. Not quite as much as you're putting on, but getting a lot closer. Much of that weight is coming from accumulating baby fat, as well as from growing organs, bones, and muscle. By now, your baby's tiny face is almost fully formed and achingly adorable, complete with a full set of eyelashes and eyebrows and a good sprinkling of hair on that head. Is your baby a brunette, a blonde, or a redhead? Actually, right now, he or she is Snow White, since there's no pigment in that hair just yet. Week 25. Baby's growing by leaps and bounds and inches and ounces, this week reaching 13 inches, over a foot long in length, and more than 1.5 pounds in weight. And there are exciting developments on the horizon, too. Capillaries are forming under the skin and filling with blood. By week's end, air sacs lined with capillaries will also develop in your baby's lungs, getting them ready for that first breath of air. Mind you, those lungs aren't ready for primetime breathing yet, and they have a lot of maturing to do before they will be. Though they're already beginning to develop surfactant, a substance that will help them expand after birth, your baby's lungs are still too undeveloped to sufficiently send oxygen to the bloodstream and release carbon dioxide from the blood, aka breathe. And speaking of breathing, your baby's nostrils, which have been plugged up until now, are starting to open up this week. This enables your little one to begin taking practice breaths. Vocal cords are functioning now too, leading to occasional hiccups, which you'll certainly be feeling. Week 26. Next time you're browsing through the meat department, pick up a 2-pound chuck roast. No, not for dinner, just so you can get a sense of how big your baby almost is this week. That's right, your baby now weighs nearly a full 2 pounds and measures in at 14 plus inches long. Another momentous development this week, your baby's eyes are beginning to open. The eyelids have been fused for the past few months, so the retina, the part of the eye that allows images to come into focus, could develop. The colored part of the eye, the iris, still doesn't have much pigmentation, so it's too early to start guessing your baby's eye color. Still, your baby is now able to see. A huge development. Sure, there's not much to see in the dark confines of the womb, but with the heightening of those senses, you may notice an increase in activity when your baby perceives a bright light or hears a loud noise. In fact, if a loud, vibrating noise is brought close to your belly, your baby will respond by blinking and startling. A good reason not to pump up the volume too much. Week 27. This week, your baby's head-to-toe length is about 14.5 inches. Your baby's weight is creeping up the charts as well, coming in at just about 2 pounds this week. And here's an interesting fetal factoid. Your little one has more taste buds now than he or she will have at birth and beyond, which means that not only is your baby able to taste the difference in the amniotic fluid when you eat different foods, but he or she might even react to it. For instance, some moms report that their babies respond to spicy foods by hiccuping or by kicking when they get that spicy kick. Will baby arrive with a taste for Tabasco? Time will tell.
Your body, the 6th month.
Here are some symptoms you may experience this month or may not experience since every pregnancy is different. Some of these symptoms may be continuing from last month, while others may be brand new. Some may be easing up, others intensifying. Physically, more definite fetal activity, continued vaginal discharge, achiness in the lower abdomen and along the sides from stretching of ligaments supporting the uterus. Constipation. Heartburn, indigestion, flatulence, bloating, occasional headaches, occasional lightheadedness or dizziness, especially when getting up quickly or when your blood sugar dips, nasal congestion and occasional nosebleeds, ear stuffiness, sensitive gums that may bleed when you brush, hearty appetite, leg cramps, mild swelling of ankles and feet, and occasionally of hands and face, hemorrhoids, varicose veins in legs and or vulva, itchy belly, A protruding navel, a popped-out belly button. Backache, patchy skin discoloration on belly and or face. Stretch marks, enlarged breasts. Emotionally, fewer mood swings, forgetfulness, absent-mindedness, aka placenta brain. A feeling like pregnancy is endless. Plenty of excitement about the future. Some worry about the future.
Your body this month. At the beginning of this month, the top of your uterus is around 1.5 inches above your belly button. By the end of the month, your uterus has grown an inch higher and the top can be felt approximately 2.5 inches above your belly button. Your uterus is the size of a basketball now, and you might even look like that's what you're carrying around in your belly. What you can expect at the 6th month checkup.
It will probably be business pretty much as usual at this month's checkup. As you end your second trimester, you can expect your practitioner to check the following, though there may be variations depending on your particular needs and on your practitioner's style of practice. Weight and blood pressure, urine for sugar and protein, fetal heartbeat, height of fundus, the top of the uterus, size of uterus and position of fetus by external palpation, feeling from the outside. Feet and hands for swelling and legs for varicose veins. Glucose screening tests usually given between 24 and 28 weeks. Symptoms you may have been experiencing, especially unusual ones. Questions and problems you might want to discuss. Have a list ready.
What you may be wondering about, the 6th month.
Trouble sleeping.
I've never had a sleep problem in my life. Until now. I can't seem to settle down at night.
Between midnight bathroom runs, a racing mind, cramping, restless legs, heartburn that's keeping you upright, a hopped-up metabolism that's keeping the heat on even when it's off, and the impossibility of getting comfortable when you're sporting a basketball in your midsection, it's no wonder you can't settle in for a good night's sleep. While this insomnia is definitely good preparation for the sleepless nights you'll encounter as a new parent, that doesn't mean you have to take it lying down or even propped up. Try the following tips for summoning the Sandman. Move your body during the day. A body that gets a workout by day will be sleepier at night. But don't exercise too close to bedtime, since the post-exercise high could keep you from crashing when your head hits the pillow. Clear your mind. If you've been losing sleep over stress at work or at home, unload it on your partner or friend earlier in the evening so it doesn't weigh you down at bedtime. If no one's around to vent to, writing your concerns down can be therapeutic. As bedtime approaches, put those worries aside, empty your head, and try thinking happy thoughts only. Meditation can help too. Be an early bird diner. A full meal and a full tummy can keep you from falling asleep and staying asleep. So try to eat your evening meal earlier in the evening. Top off before you turn in. A too empty tummy can also keep you up. To keep low blood sugar and the midnight munchies from waking you, have a light snack as part of your bedtime routine. That sleepy standard warm milk may be especially effective even if you no longer get tucked in with your teddy. Add a whole grain muffin for blood sugar sustaining complex carbs and substitute almond milk if heartburn strikes you at night. Or nibble on some cheese and crackers. Slow the flow. If frequent trips to the bathroom are standing between you and a good night's sleep, limit fluids after 6 p.m. Just get enough fluids before then. Drink if you're thirsty, but don't guzzle a 16-ounce bottle of water right before bedtime. Don't get buzzed. Avoid caffeine in the afternoon and evening. Its effects can keep you buzzing into the night. Ditto for sugar, especially when combined with caffeine, as in a white chocolate mocha, which will give you an energy boost when you least want one, and then leave your blood sugar levels wobbly during the night. Give yourself a bedtime routine. It's not just for kids. The relaxing repetition of the right bedtime rituals can help adults settle down for a good night's sleep too. Easy does it, so focus on activities that slow you down. Practice in a predictable order. Good options to consider adding to your routine, light reading, but nothing you can't put down, or soothing music, serene yoga poses, or relaxation exercises, a warm bath, a back rub, plus that other bedtime snack, sex. Download. Sleep? There are plenty of apps for that too. Explore some of the better-rated sleep apps, from those that rely on self-guided meditation to those that use nature sounds and other white noise. And while you're at it, try meditating to relieve daily stress that might be keeping you up. Wean off the screen. Using your phone, tablet, e-reader, laptop, or other electronic device before bed for anything other than a sleep or white noise app can mess with your Z's. Light from the screen alters sleepiness and alertness and also suppresses levels of melatonin, the hormone that regulates your internal clock and plays a role in your sleep cycle. Experts say you should power down your devices at least an hour before turning in. Get comfy. There is no such thing as too many pillows when you're pregnant. Use them to prop you up, support you where you need it, or just cozy up to. Be sure, too, that your bedroom isn't too hot or too cold. Just can't get comfy in your bed? Try snoozing semi-upright in a recliner, which will allow you to stay on your back without actually lying flat on your back. Get some air. It's hard to get sleepy when it's stuffy. Weather permitting, crack a window. If not, run a fan to circulate the air. And don't sleep with the covers over your head. This will decrease the oxygen and increase the carbon dioxide you breathe in, which can cause headaches. Ask before you pop. While there are sleep aids that are safe for occasional use during pregnancy, don't take any sleep aid, prescription, over-the-counter, or herbal unless it's been prescribed or okay by your practitioner. If your practitioner has recommended that you take a magnesium supplement or a calcium-magnesium supplement to combat constipation or leg cramps, it makes sense to take it before bed, because magnesium, touted for its natural muscle-relaxing powers, may help lull you to sleep. Smell your way to sleep. A lavender-scented pillow that you tuck into bed with you, or a lavender sachet slipped between the pillowcase and pillow, can help relax you and bring on sleep faster. Save your bed for sleep, cuddling, and sex. Don't invite activities you associate with being wide awake and wired, work, paying bills, even shopping for baby gear, into your bed. Avoid clock watching. Judge whether you're getting enough sleep by how you feel, not by how many hours you stay in bed. You're getting enough rest if you're not chronically tired, beyond the normal fatigue of pregnancy. And speaking of midnight hours, if the sight of those glowing numbers and the hours ticking by on the clock stresses you out, turn it so you can't see it. Don't just lie there. When sleep's eluding you and you've run out of baby sheep to count, do something relaxing. Read, listen to music, meditate until you feel sleepy. Don't lose sleep over losing sleep. Stressing about your lack of shut-eye will only make it harder to grab any. In fact, sometimes just letting go of that "will I ever fall asleep" worry is all it takes to drop off into dreamland.
For dads, when she can't sleep. She's making a baby, but chances are she isn't sleeping like one. So instead of snoring up a storm next time your partner's pregnancy insomnia strikes, consider keeping her company while she waits for the Sandman to show. Buy her a body pillow to help get her comfy, or build her a cozy fort of support with your extra pillows. Relax her with a back rub, run her a bath, bring her a warm cup of milk and a muffin. Do a little pillow talking. Cuddle as needed and as wanted. And if one thing leads to another, and she's up for a sexual nightcap, you might both sleep better.
An umbilical hernia. Most mamas-to-be expect their belly buttons to pop when their bumps do. But for some women, that popping navel is more than a sign there's a baby on board. It's an umbilical hernia. An umbilical hernia happens when there is a small hole in the abdominal wall, which allows abdominal tissue, like loops of the small intestine, to protrude through the umbilical area. Most umbilical hernias are congenital, meaning present at birth. In fact, umbilical hernias are common in newborns. You can read all about that in What to Expect the First Year. usually closing up quickly on their own. Even when a small hole doesn't close up, it's not likely to cause problems or even be noticeable. That is, until a growing uterus starts applying pressure, causing the hernia to get bigger, sometimes leading to a painful bulging around the belly button. Expecting multiples can multiply your odds of an umbilical hernia. After all, there's more growing going on in your uterus. How will you know if you have an umbilical hernia? You might feel a soft lump around your belly button. It might be more noticeable when you lie down. And you might see a bulge under the skin. You might also have a dull, achy pain in the belly button area that becomes more noticeable when you're active, bend over, sneeze, cough, or laugh hard. You can wear a belly band to help keep the hernia from bulging and causing pain. Some women find relief by gently massaging the lump until the bulging goes back in. Or, if it's not bothering you, you can choose to do nothing at all. If, once you deliver your baby, the hernia doesn't recede on its own, or with the help of special exercises recommended by your practitioner, surgery may be required to repair it. Surgery is not recommended during pregnancy unless a loop of bowel slips through the hole and becomes trapped, herniated, risking a loss of blood supply to that area. In that case, your practitioner may recommend that you have a simple operation to repair the hernia, usually during the second trimester. The same applies to the far less common inguinal hernia, when tissue pushes through a weak spot in your groin muscle, resulting in a bulge in the groin, which can be caused by the pressure from your growing uterus. A belly band can help keep your growing abdomen from pressing on the inguinal hernia during pregnancy, and if the hernia doesn't recede on its own after you deliver, surgery can repair it, though surgery may need to be performed during the second trimester if a loop of bowel gets trapped.
Popped belly button.
My belly button used to be a perfect innie. Now it's sticking all the way out. Will it stay that way even after I deliver?
Has your innie been outed? Is it poking straight through your clothes these days? Taking on a life of its own? Don't worry, there's nothing novel about navels that pop during pregnancy. Just about every belly button does at some point. As the swelling uterus pushes forward, even the deepest innie is sure to pop like a timer on a turkey. Except on most women, the navel pops well before baby's done. Your belly button should revert to its regular position a few months after delivery, though it may bear the mommy mark, that somewhat stretched out, lived-in look. Until then, you can look at the bright side of your protruding navel. It gives you a chance to clean out all the lint that's accumulated there since you were a kid. If you find that the outie look doesn't quite work with the clingy fashion statement you're trying to make, or if your poor outie is getting irritated from rubbing against your clothing, you can use a specially designed belly button cover to smooth and protect it. Pregnancy support products like tummy sleeves or tummy shapers can also hide that popped out navel, or just wear it out and proud as yet another pregnancy badge of honor. Some women report belly button pain or sensitivity that's unrelated to an umbilical hernia. It's unclear what causes the pain, could be from stretching or just irritation, but it's nothing to be concerned about and will eventually go away. In the meantime, warm compresses or wearing a belly band can help relieve any pain. Baby kicking.
Some days the baby is kicking all the time. Other days he seems very quiet. Is this normal?
Fetuses are only human. Just like us, they have up days when they feel like kicking up their heels and elbows and knees, and down days when they'd rather lie back and take it easy. Most often their activity is related to your activities. Like babies out of the womb, fetuses are lulled by rocking. So when you're on the go all day, your baby is likely to be pacified by the rhythm of your routine, and you're likely not to notice much kicking, partly because baby is slowed down, partly because you're so busy. As soon as you slow down or relax, your little one's bound to start acting up, a pattern babies tend to continue even after they're born. That's why you're more apt to feel fetal movement in bed at night or when you're resting during the day. Activity may increase, too, after you've had a meal or snack, perhaps in reaction to the surge of sugar in your blood. You may also notice increased fetal activity when you're excited or nervous, about to give a presentation, for example, possibly because the baby is stimulated by your adrenaline response, or when baby gets a jolt of caffeine from your morning latte, or hears an already familiar song playing. Babies are actually most active between weeks 24 and 28, when they're small enough to belly dance, somersault, kickbox, and do a full aerobic step class in their roomy uterine home. But their movements are erratic and usually brief, so they aren't always felt by a busy mom-to-be, even though they are visible on ultrasound. Fetal activity usually becomes more organized and consistent with more clearly defined periods of rest and activity between weeks 28 and 32. It's definitely felt later and less emphatically when there's an anterior placenta getting in the way, and sometimes when a mom has a lot of abdominal fat muffling the kicks. Don't be tempted to compare baby movement notes with other pregnant women. Each fetus, like each newborn, has an individual pattern of activity and development. Some seem always active, others mostly quiet. The activity of some fetuses is so regular their moms could set their watches by it. In others, there's no discernible activity pattern at all. As long as movements don't suddenly slow down significantly or stop entirely, all variations are normal. Keeping track of your baby's kicks isn't necessary until week 28, so don't worry if you haven't felt your baby's movements for a day or two at this point in your pregnancy.
Sometimes the baby kicks so hard it hurts.
As babies mature in the uterus, they grow stronger and stronger, and those once butterfly-like fetal movements pack more and more punch. Which is why you shouldn't be surprised if you get kicked in the ribs or poked in the abdomen with such force that it hurts. When you seem to be under a particularly fierce attack, try changing your position. It may knock your little linebacker off balance and temporarily stem the assault.
Posting pregnancy. If sharing is caring, there's a whole lot of caring going on when it comes to baby bumps. Mommy social media is loaded with uploaded baby bump selfies, belly-bearing pregnancy portraits, and ultrasound pics. And as your own bump grows, maybe you're wondering whether you, too, should hop carefully onto the pregnancy selfie bandwagon and push share. Capturing your bump on camera as it grows, grows, grows is priceless. It'll ensure you'll have pregnancy images to reminisce about long after your baby has made the move from your belly to your arms. So as they say, take a picture, it'll last longer. But should you share those most special of selfies with the world of social media, or even with family and friends on Facebook? Or post those first ultrasound glimpses of your baby, yes, including the money shot? Going public or staying private is a personal choice. If you do opt to showcase your baby bump and baby-to-be's first pictures online, remember that whatever you put online lives online forever. And in this case, you've begun to build your little one's digital footprint before he or she is even born. Ask yourself if you're okay with that. While you're asking, make sure your spouse is happy with all the social media sharing too. Pay attention to who can see the images that you've posted, and be sure both of you are on board with any images you post on an open network that anyone can access.
Measuring large or small.
According to my pregnancy app and the due date my midwife gave me, I'm supposed to be 26 weeks. But at this appointment, she told me my uterus is measuring only 24 weeks. Does that mean there's something wrong with the baby?
Your uterus, like your baby, is one of a kind, and so is its growth. Some moms measure a little bigger, some a little smaller, just like the baby inside them, with an average uterine size for a certain day, just that, an average. What's more, measuring your uterus or your baby, especially from the outside, isn't a precise science, which means your practitioner's measurement won't always correlate with your dates, and that's perfectly okay. At each prenatal visit, your practitioner checks your fundal height, the distance from your pubic bone to the top of your uterus, with a tape measure. See why the science isn't so precise? That number in centimeters is approximately equal to the number of weeks of pregnancy you are, but 1 or 2 centimeters in either direction is no big deal. In fact, a discrepancy of a couple of weeks, again in either direction, is pretty typical because fundal height can be affected by many factors other than baby size, including your body type, the baby's position, the volume of fluid on a particular day, and so on. High-tech, this process isn't. And the truth is, even far higher-tech measurements done via ultrasound aren't super accurate after the first trimester. If your measurements show a discrepancy of 3 weeks or more at any point, your practitioner will do a little investigating to try to learn why. Most of the time, there's a harmless explanation. Maybe your baby's genetically destined to be larger or smaller than average, or your EDD is off by a week. Due dates are also an estimate, remember? Or perhaps there's something that requires more looking into, like a uterine fibroid, extra or too little amniotic fluid, or a baby that's not growing as expected, IUGR, or is growing bigger than expected, sometimes due to gestational diabetes. Itchy belly.
My belly itches constantly. It's driving me crazy.
Join the club. Pregnant bellies are itchy bellies, and they can become progressively itchier as the months pass. That's because as your belly grows, the skin stretches rapidly, becoming increasingly moisture-deprived, leaving it itchy and uncomfortable. Try not to scratch, which will only make you itchier and could cause irritation. Moisturizing can temporarily curb the itching, so massage that bump frequently and liberally with a pure cream, lotion, or oil. Shea butter or cocoa butter are favorites, and ones made with aloe can also be soothing. An oatmeal bath can soothe itchiness too, but before you reach for any anti-itching lotions, check with your practitioner. If you have an all-over itch that doesn't seem to be related to dry or sensitive skin, or you develop a rash on your abdomen, check with your practitioner.
When something just doesn't feel right. Maybe it's a twinge of abdominal pain that feels too much like a cramp to ignore. A sudden change in your vaginal discharge, an aching in your lower back or in your pelvic floor, or maybe it's something so vague you can't even put your finger on it. Chances are it's just par for the pregnancy course, but to play it safe, see if a call to your practitioner is in order. If you can't find your symptoms on the list, it's probably a good idea to call anyway. Remember, you know your body better than anyone. Listen up when it's trying to tell you something.
Clumsiness.
Lately, I've been dropping everything I pick up. Why am I suddenly so clumsy?
Like the extra inches on your belly, the extra thumbs on your hand are part of the pregnancy package. This real, and unfortunately plain for everyone to see, pregnancy-induced clumsiness is caused by the loosening of joints and ligaments and the retention of water, both of which can make your grasp on objects less firm and sure. A lack of concentration as a result of pregnancy forgetfulness can contribute to clumsiness too, as can brain circuits overloaded by baby prep and baby daydreams. So can a decline in dexterity caused by swollen fingers and carpal tunnel syndrome. There's not much you can do to counter your expectant klutz factor. You can, in fact, expect to get only clumsier in the coming months, particularly at the end of each day, when your mind is least focused and your hands are most puffy. The best strategy, avoid handling breakables, especially ones you don't own, like the precious porcelain frame for baby's room you are eyeing at the store. Keep your grandmother's crystals safely tucked into the cabinet for now. Don't volunteer to clear the table at your pal's dinner party when she's using the good china, and have someone else load and unload the dishwasher. Keep your phone protected in a sturdy case. Numbness in the hands.
I keep waking up in the middle of the night because some of the fingers on my right hand are numb. Does that have anything to do with being pregnant?
Feeling all a tingle these days? Chances are it isn't romance or even excitement about the baby. It's the normal numbness and tingling in the fingers and toes that many expectant moms experience, probably the result of swelling tissues pressing on the nerves. If the numbness and pain are confined to your thumb, index finger, middle finger, and half of your ring finger, you probably have carpal tunnel syndrome, CTS. Though CTS is most common in people who regularly perform repetitive motions of the hand or wrist, like typing or piano playing, it's also extremely common in pregnant women, even those who don't do a lot of repetitive hand motions. That's because the carpal tunnel in the wrist, through which the nerve to the affected fingers runs, becomes swollen during pregnancy, as do so many other tissues in the body, you might have noticed, with the result in pressure causing numbness, tingling, burning, and pain. The symptoms can also affect the hand and wrist, and they can radiate up the arm. Though CTS symptoms can strike at any time of the day, you might feel yourself wrestling with wrist pain more often at night. That's because fluids accumulated in your feet and legs during the day are redistributed to the rest of your body, including your hands, when you lie down at night. Sleeping on your hands can make the problem worse, so try elevating them on a separate pillow. Typically, CTS symptoms resolve sometime after delivery, once all that pregnancy swelling goes down. In the meantime, acupuncture may bring relief, as can a wrist splint, though you may find wearing one more uncomfortable than the CTS itself. As for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and steroids usually prescribed for CTS, ask your practitioner. They may not be recommended during pregnancy. If you think the CTS is related to your work habits or other keyboard use, try to adjust your keyboard, your mouse, and find a more comfortable position. Leg cramps.
I have leg cramps at night that keep me awake.
Between your overloaded mind and your bulging belly, you probably have enough trouble catching those Z's without leg cramps cramping your sleeping style. Unfortunately, these painful spasms that radiate up and down your calves and occur most often at night are very common among the expectant set in the second and third trimesters. No one's quite sure what causes leg cramps. Various theories blame fatigue from carrying pregnancy weight, compression of the blood vessels in the legs, and possibly diet, an excess of phosphorus and a shortage of calcium or magnesium. You might as well blame hormones too. What are the odds they're not to blame? But whatever the cause of the leg cramps in your case, there are ways of both preventing and alleviating them. When a leg cramp strikes, straighten your leg right away and flex your ankle and toes slowly up towards your nose. Don't point your toes. You can do this in bed, but you may find faster relief if you get up and do it on your feet. This should soon ease the pain. Doing this several times with each leg before turning in at night may even help ward off the cramps later. Stretching exercises can also help stop cramps before they strike. Before you head to bed, stand about 2 feet away from a wall and put your palms flat against it. Lean forward, keeping your heels on the floor. Hold the stretch for 10 seconds, then relax for 5. Repeat 3 times. To ease the daily load on your legs, put your feet up as often as you can. Alternate periods of activity with periods of rest, and wear support hose during the day. Flex your feet periodically. Try standing on a cool surface, which can sometimes stop a spasm. An ice pack or cool compress may also help. You can add massage or local heat for added relief if the pain has subsided. Do not massage or add heat if pain persists. Make sure you're drinking enough fluids. Eat a well-balanced diet that includes plenty of calcium and magnesium, but also check with your practitioner to see if you should add a magnesium supplement before bed. Really bad leg cramps can cause muscle soreness, like a Charlie horse that lasts a few days. That's nothing to worry about, but if the pain is severe and persists, contact your practitioner, because there's a slight possibility that a blood clot may have developed in a vein, making medical treatment necessary.
Bleeding in mid or late pregnancy. It's always unsettling to see pink or red on your underwear when you're expecting, but spotting in the second or third trimester is often not a cause for concern. Sometimes it's the result of bruising to the increasingly sensitive cervix during an internal exam or sex, or it could simply be triggered by causes unknown and innocuous. Still, it's important to let your practitioner know about any spotting or bleeding, because it could also be a sign of preterm delivery, placental abruption, or another serious condition. If you're bleeding heavily, Or if the spotting is accompanied by pain or discomfort, call your practitioner right away. Ultrasound, a physical exam, lab work, and/or fetal monitoring can often determine whether there's a problem, and if so, how to treat or manage it.
Hemorrhoids.
I'm dreading getting hemorrhoids. I've heard they're common during pregnancy. Is there anything I can do to prevent them?
It's a big pain in the butt, but more than half of all expectant moms develop hemorrhoids, which are just veins in the rectum that become swollen, like so many other things during pregnancy. Pressure from your enlarging uterus plus increased blood flow to the pelvic area not only cause those veins to swell, but to bulge and itch. How's that for a pleasant thought? Because they can resemble a pile of grapes or marbles, hemorrhoids also go by the nickname piles. Thinking pile prevention, your best strategy may be to avoid piling on extra pounds, since added weight means added pressure on your rectal veins. Constipation and straining to poop when you're constipated can contribute to hemorrhoids too, so do your best to stay regular. Doing your Kegels can also ward off hemorrhoids by improving circulation to the area, as can taking the pressure off by sleeping on your side, not your back, and avoiding standing or sitting for long periods of time or lingering on the toilet. Sitting with your feet on a low stool when you're on the toilet may make that other stool easier to pass, so pushing is less of a strain. So, prevention didn't do the trick? To soothe the sting of hemorrhoids, try applying witch hazel pads, cool compresses, or ice packs. A warm bath or bottom-only sitz bath, which you can do with a basin that fits over the toilet seat, may ease discomfort too, and wiping gently with damp toilet paper can reduce irritation. If sitting is a pain, use a donut-shaped pillow to ease pressure. Ask your practitioner before using any medication, topical or otherwise. Hemorrhoids can sometimes bleed, especially when you're bearing down during a bowel movement, though anal fissures, painful cracks in the skin of the anus caused by straining from constipation, can also be the cause of rectal bleeding. To rule out any less likely cause, check in with your practitioner about any rectal bleeding. If there's good news about hemorrhoids, it's that they're not dangerous, just uncomfortable. They usually go away sometime after delivery, though they can occasionally be aggravated or even develop for the first time postpartum as a result of pushing during childbirth.
Diagnosing preeclampsia. Chances are you've heard of or know someone who developed preeclampsia during pregnancy, but the reality is preeclampsia isn't that common, occurring in only about 3 to 8% of pregnancies, even in its mildest form. And luckily, in women who are receiving regular prenatal care, preeclampsia can be diagnosed and treated early, preventing needless complications. Though routine office visits sometimes seem a waste of time in a healthy pregnancy, I have to pee in a cup again? That's when the earliest signs of preeclampsia are usually picked up. Early symptoms of preeclampsia include a rise in blood pressure, protein in the urine, severe swelling of the hands and face, persistent severe headaches, pain in the stomach or the esophagus, and/or vision disturbances. If you experience any of these, call your practitioner. Otherwise, assuming you are getting regular medical care, there's no reason to worry about preeclampsia.
Breast lump.
I'm worried about a small, tender lump on the side of my breast. What could it be?
Though they're still months away from being able to feed your baby, it sounds like your breasts are already gearing up. The result? A clogged milk duct. These red, tender-to-the-touch hard lumps in the breasts are very common even this early in pregnancy, especially in second and subsequent pregnancies. Warm compresses or letting warm water run on it in the shower and gentle massage will probably clear up the duct in a few days, just as they will during lactation. Some experts suggest that avoiding underwire bras also helps, but make sure you get ample support from the bra you do wear. Keep in mind that monthly self-exams of your breasts shouldn't stop when you're pregnant. Though checking for lumps is trickier when you're expecting because of the changes in your breasts, they're naturally lumpier, firmer, and heavier than before, it's still important to try. Show any lump to your practitioner at your next visit or check in sooner if you're concerned. Glucose screening test.
My practitioner says I need to take a glucose screening test. Why would I need it, and what does it involve?
Don't feel too picked on. Almost all practitioners screen for gestational diabetes, GD, in almost all expectant moms at about 24 to 28 weeks. Moms who are at higher risk for GD, including older or obese moms, or those with a family history of diabetes, are screened even earlier in their pregnancies. So chances are the test your practitioner ordered is just routine. And it's simple too, especially if you have a sweet tooth. You'll drink a very sweet glucose drink, which usually tastes like flat orange, lemon lime, or grape soda, an hour before having some blood drawn. The drink is definitely not delicious, but most women are able to chug a lug this stuff with no problem and no side effects. A few, especially those who don't have a taste for sweet liquids, feel a little queasy afterward. Depending on your practitioner's preference, you may not have to fast for this test. If the blood work comes back with elevated numbers, which suggests the possibility that you might not be producing enough insulin to process the extra glucose in your system, the next level of tests, the glucose tolerance test, is ordered. This 3-hour test, which involves fasting and then drinking a higher concentration glucose drink, is used to diagnose GD. GD occurs in about 7 to 9% of expectant moms, which makes it one of the most common pregnancy complications. Fortunately, it's also one of the most easily managed. When blood sugar is closely controlled through diet, exercise, and if necessary, medication, women with GD are likely to have perfectly normal pregnancies and healthy babies. Cord blood banking.
I've seen a lot of ads about cord blood banking. Should I consider doing it?
As if you don't have enough to think about before a baby's born, here's something else to consider. Should you save your baby's umbilical cord blood? And if so, how? Cord blood harvesting is a simple, painless procedure that takes less than 5 minutes and is performed after the cord has been clamped and cut. It's completely safe for both mom and baby, as long as the cord is not clamped and cut prematurely. Why collect and store cord blood instead of tossing it, as is usually done? Because a newborn's cord blood contains many types of stem cells, including cells with the incredible capacity to turn into any other kind of blood and immune system cells that can, in some cases, be used to treat certain immune system disorders or blood diseases. The stem cells in cord blood are already considered a standard treatment for a variety of diseases, including leukemias, cancers of the blood immune system, bone marrow cancers, lymphomas and neuroblastoma, inherited red blood cell abnormalities such as sickle cell disease and anemias, Gaucher disease and Hurler syndrome, and inherited immune system and immune cell disorders. What's more, cord blood stem cells are also being investigated as possible treatments for other conditions and diseases, ranging from diabetes and cerebral palsy to autism and certain heart defects present at birth. You can also save placental tissue and blood from placental cells, which may contain even more stem cells. There are two ways to store the blood. You can pay for private storage, or you can donate the blood to a public storage bank. Private storage can be expensive, costing a couple of $1,000s or more for the collection of the blood, plus yearly maintenance fees, plus the fee for the doctor and hospital if they offer cord blood collection. Some private banks offer free or discounted banking if there's a family medical need, such as a family member who's in need of a transplant, or a family history of a condition that qualifies them to participate in a trial, autism, for instance. Discounts are also often given for military families and those of first responders. You can check whether your health insurance company gives discounts or partial reimbursement for private banking. The benefits of private cord blood banking, if your family has no history of immune disorders currently being treated with cord blood stem cells, isn't completely clear. Also not clear is how many years the frozen units will remain viable. Different companies make different claims about their storage equipment. If you can't afford the price of private banking, there's no downside, though realistically, it's very unlikely that your baby or another family member will ever end up with a condition that can be treated with the stored cells. What are the official recommendations? ACOG doesn't take a stand, but recommends that doctors present parents with the pros and cons of both private and public banking. The American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, doesn't recommend private cord blood storage unless a family member has a medical condition that might be helped by a stem cell transplant now or in the near future. The AAP, however, does support parents donating the cord blood to a bank for general use by the public. Studies show that the likelihood that a child will ever tap into his or her own saved cord blood is very low. 1 in 2,700 to 1 in 20,000, by some estimates. In fact, experts point out that a baby's own cord blood cells are often unsuitable for treating a condition that shows up later in the child's life, like leukemia, because the mutations ultimately responsible for the condition are present at birth and can be found in those cells. What about treating an adult family member with the stored cells later on? The likelihood of that is also low, since most stored units of cord blood don't contain enough stem cells to treat anyone weighing more than 90 pounds. The chances are somewhat higher that you'd be able to use the stored cord blood to help treat a young sibling who has or develops a certain disease. Public banking is open to any family, as long as the hospital where you're delivering offers it. The upside is that it's free and could ultimately save a life, including your own child, since the more cord blood donations there are, the higher the chances that you'll be able to find a suitable match if your child should need one. In fact, the odds of finding a suitably matched, publicly donated, unrelated cord blood unit are already quite high and continue to improve as inventories of public cord blood banks grow. A good reason to think about donating your babies. The downside is that you can't access your own child's cord blood cells once they're donated. One thing is for sure, there's no benefit to letting your baby's cord blood get tossed. To make sure that those precious blood cells don't go to waste, talk about the options available to you with your practitioner. Maybe you'll decide that private banking makes sense for your family, either because of the family history or because you can easily afford the extra price. Maybe you'll decide that public banking is the way to go. Either way, remember that you'll need to make this decision well before those first contractions strike and to make sure everyone on your birth team is in on your plan and ready to implement it. As to about placental tissue banking, something that more cord blood companies are offering these days.
I'm considering storing my baby's umbilical cord blood in a private bank, but I'm not sure how to go about doing it.
The first step is to partner up with your practitioner on your plan, not only so you can get your practitioner's take on cord blood banking, but also so you can make sure he or she is willing and able to collect the cord blood. It's rare that a doctor or midwife couldn't or wouldn't perform this simple and quick procedure, but a fee may be involved. Then it's time to hit the books, or at least the internet, to do your research so you can find the right cord blood bank for you. Any bank you're considering should be accredited with the American Association of Blood Banks, AABB. Once you've narrowed your choices, it's worth calling each one to find out more about their services. You'll want the bank's representative to explain key things: how the bank collects and stores the blood. There are different collection and storage methods. You'll want to choose a bank that has demonstrated good odds of getting a usable blood sample. How stable the company is. You don't want the bank to go out of business, so explore the pros and cons of choosing a lesser-known, smaller bank versus a larger, well-known bank that has been operating for longer. And what they actually store. Some banks store only cord blood, while others store the cord and blood tissue from around the blood vessels in the cord that contain different types of stem cells. Once you've made your pick, it's time to enroll with the bank of your choice. Aim to sign up by the end of your second trimester, or at least before week 34. Once you sign up, the cord blood bank will mail you a collection kit so that you'll have it on hand for the big day. The kit will probably have a medical form for you to fill out, plus sealed medical supplies your practitioner will use to collect the cord blood. Fill out the form, sign it, and put it back in the kit, but leave the kit's medical supplies sealed. Pack the kit away in your hospital bag so you won't have to scramble to find it when those contractions hit. Once you're in labor, it's time to give the cord blood kit to your practitioner or the staff. This will remind him or her about your cord blood banking decision, and it will alert the medical staff that they'll need to collect a blood sample from you before delivery. The kit comes with the materials your practitioner will need to collect and send in your blood. Right after you deliver, whether it's a vaginal or cesarean delivery, your practitioner will clamp the umbilical cord. He or she can and should wait until the cord stops pulsating to allow for delayed cord clamping, and collect the cord blood with the supplies provided in your kit. Your partner can still cut the cord because that doesn't affect the collection process. When the collection is complete, it's time for you, or more likely your partner since you'll be a little distracted, or your practitioner or staff, to call the bank. Once the call is made, the bank will arrange for a courier to pick up the cord blood kit and send it off to the laboratory for storage. The kit will arrive at the lab no later than 36 hours after you deliver your precious bundle. The bank will contact you to let you know that your cord blood has arrived safely and to tell you how much they were able to collect and process. They will also, of course, send you a yearly bill for storage fees. Keep in mind that you may not be able to collect and store enough of your baby's cord blood if he or she is born preterm, even if you plan for it, or if your twins share a placenta, then check with your chosen bank for guidelines to be certain. You may also find cord blood banking is a struggle to arrange if you are based overseas, but would like to bank or donate your baby's blood in the U.S.
I'd like to donate my baby's cord blood to a public bank. What's the best way to do that?
First, know that the decision you've made might save a life someday. Cord blood contains stem cells that can treat a host of diseases, and most major medical organizations, including the AAP, encourage public donation of umbilical cord blood cells so they can be used for actual transplants or for valuable medical research, a far better option than letting that precious cord blood be thrown away. Then it's time to share your decision with your practitioner. Together, you can determine if you qualify for public donation, which you most likely will unless you're HIV positive or have an STD, hepatitis, or cancer, and start making the arrangements necessary to bank publicly. You may also want to find out whether your practitioner charges a fee for collecting the cord blood, even if it's being donated to a public bank that accepts all donations free of charge. Donating your baby's cord blood will be easiest if you'll be delivering at a hospital that participates in the National Cord Blood Donation Program run through the